Alexa Philippou, you've been in Portland for the women's regional finals. So let's just start from the top here, specifically at the top of the three-point arc. What happened?
It was right when Texas and NC State were fighting for a spot to go to Cleveland in the Final Four. And we actually found out because it was on the ESPN broadcast. Turns out one of the three-point arcs in Portland was drawn incorrectly.
Now, we do have some news that we want to share with you coming out of Portland as our next matchup is about to get underway. Now, unfortunately, what they have discovered and what you're looking at right now is that in Portland, the three-point lines are different on the different sides of the court.
I had never seen or heard of anything like that happening before in my life, let alone on a stage like the regional round. So, yes, they had played with this incorrectly drawn three-point arc for all the Sweet 16 games. They alerted the coaches before this Elite Eight matchup, and they agreed to proceed with the game regardless.
How did everybody react when such a major flaw was noticed?
Everyone couldn't believe it, that this was something that no one had caught up till then, that potentially could have gone unnoticed, and then in retrospect seemed almost like, oh, maybe we should have all noticed this beforehand. But I definitely think there was some outrage, including from Stanford coach Tara Vanderveer, one of the legends of the sport, who said that it was really unacceptable for something like that to happen. But I will say, I think one of my highlights of my entire time in Portland was going out onto the court after USC's practice on Sunday with a few other reporters, one of whom had bought a measuring tape from a local hardware store. And we were just kind of nosing around and trying to see if we could actually measure the distance that was the issue and see what the discrepancy was. We were promptly escorted off the court by some NCAA officials who, they're just
really
doing their job.
Official measurements only, Alexa.
Official measurements only, indeed.
Well, it's a good thing, though, that it didn't take away from these games. It wasn't the greatest storyline of the weekend because the games definitely held up for themselves.
By the time Monday came around and UConn was able to win in this epic battle with USC, which was coming off another epic battle between LSU and Iowa across the country, in the first game of the day, no one was talking about the three-point arc. They were just talking about the great basketball, the great stars, and the great games that we have to come next week in Cleveland.
If you need any more evidence of the explosive growth of women's basketball, look no further than Monday night, when Iowa's Elite Eight victory over Louisiana State drew 12.3 million viewers. It's not just the most ever for a women's college game. It also eclipsed average viewers for last year's World Series and NBA Finals. And we still have two rounds to go. So as the Final Four gets ready to tip off in Cleveland Friday night, our expert, Alexa Philippou, reads between the now officially measured lines to tell us everything we need to know. I'm Israel Gutierrez, in for Clinton Yates. It's Thursday, April 4th. This is ESPN Daily.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Alexa, it seems like since the brackets came out, we were looking for this rematch, LSU versus Iowa. Even the coaches said they wished it was coming in the Final Four, but it happened in the regional final on a night that felt like a Final Four night. Frankly, the stars showed up Caitlin Clark, a few early turnovers, but really started to heat up after that. And LSU's Angel Reese started off pretty much on fire, but cooled off a little bit after injuring her ankle there. How was Iowa able to handle, I want to say, everything LSU threw at them, but they didn't throw that much at Caitlin Clark, did they?
Well, Kim Mulkey said something to the effect after the game. You're not going to really be able to defend Caitlin Clark.
Iowa with numbers. Here's Clark. Catch, fire, and hit.
I think she actually said there's not a lot of strategy. So even last year when they beat Iowa and Clark in the final, they didn't even necessarily guard her particularly well. But this, it felt like, was a whole nother level.
Clark wheels around, evades Van Lith, and drains it. My goodness.
She finished with 41 points and 12 assists. Again, in the Elite Eight, it's just remarkable that a player could be doing this at that stage. What stuck out to me was her three-point shooting. She made 9 threes of 20 attempts, but you know, she made more threes than the entire LSU team, and it kind of exposed, I thought, some of the problems we'd seen from the Tigers all year long. It was a real shame that Angel Reese, though, did get injured. She was really strong early on.
And the rebound ends up with LSU. Here is Reese. Clark back there, and Reese lays it in. Angel Reese having a tremendous opening quarter.
She was 5-7 from the field and had 10 points at the time that she re-injured that ankle that she initially hurt in the SEC tournament. And so before that, injury was a huge impact. But you could tell, and hearing also people that were there in Albany, they really emphasized that her mobility was limited. Even though the game was tied at halftime, LSU just collapsed, it felt like, in the third quarter as Clark just was able to go on her own heater and hit shot after shot. And LSU couldn't keep up and shot only 5 of 26. And that was enough for Iowa to build that lead, and they never really looked back.
There were the stories that did drop about Kim Mulkey, the one Washington Post story that was discussed so much because Kim Mulkey essentially threatened a lawsuit. And then there was the LA Times column by their beat writer that got a lot of attention and was called sexist by Mulkey, was called racist by Haley Van Lith. I know that was about the UCLA-LSU matchup. How much was all of that just sort of a microcosm of their season, they continuously having to overcome things that weren't necessarily on the basketball court?
It really felt like that for the Tigers. I mean, there was always something, it felt like. Sometimes it was just completely out of their control. They could not have really ever imagined that this column would have come out, and it was obviously so inappropriate. There was the on-court stuff, too, that took some time to come along. There was, you know, the absence of Angel Reese for four games that was publicly really unexplained and caused a lot of controversy. There was people leaving the team, people getting hurt, and, you know, inexplicable losses, it felt like, or the fact that this team had so much talent and it didn't completely ever come together in a way that resulted in what they all thought it would, in a championship. But what stuck out to me, even from afar, was that they really showed this togetherness and unity at the end of the day. And that was something that maybe a lot of people thought or were rooting for this team to crumble, that they thought that with so much star power, they wouldn't have each other's backs. But even before the loss, the way that Haley Van Lith was calling out that LA Times column.
And so I think I wish we hadn't have read that, because I think that can crush your soul a little bit, that someone would ever say that about us that doesn't know us.
And the way that Van Lith and Flaje Johnson stood up on that press conference after the loss yesterday and were able to talk about the fact that Angel Reese has been through so much and has been really, in a lot of ways, unfairly criticized, and people don't know her, and you know how great of a teammate she is, and that they had her back.
Y'all don't know Angel Reese. I know Angel Reese. I know the real Angel Reese. And the person I see every day is a strong person. Is a caring, loving person, bro. The crown she wears is heavy, bro.
I thought that said a lot about a team that everyone seemed to have an opinion on, and they kind of had the last word in a way. It was a good reminder that these kids have such a spotlight on them that they've never had before really in the sport, given how much attention is on women's basketball. And some of it does cross the line, and and that they have to navigate that in an era that's unlike anything that college athletics has seen before. So I thought it was a really powerful way to end and to go out.
Yeah, Alexa, fame in general just seems like it's so much harder these days. And for somebody in Angel's position, you could see how much of that weight she was carrying around all season long in that post-game press conference where she showed some vulnerability.
I don't really get to stand up for myself. I mean, I have great teammates. I have a great support system. I got my hometown. I got my family that stands up for me. I don't really get to speak out on things just because I just try to ignore and I just try to stand strong. Like, I've been through so much. I've seen so much. I've been attacked so many times. Death threats. I've been sexualized. I've been threatened. I've been so many things, and I've stood strong every single time. And I just try to stand strong for my teammates because I don't want them to see me down and, like, not be there for them.
So now that Angel Reese has declared for the WNBA draft, in a Vogue fashion shoot, no less, do you think she leaves LSU feeling complete? And what's next for the Tigers?
Yeah, Angel's done so much at LSU. I mean, she's won a national championship. She's really put that program on the map. She's put herself into that level of stardom. I think when we think about LSU reloading, we know Kim Mulkey and what she can do in the transfer portal. Anissa Mora will be back, and Michaela Williams was such a promising freshman this year. But I think in some ways, this postseason really showed that this could be Flaje Johnson's team now.
All right, let's get back to the winners of that game, the Iowa Hawkeyes. They go on to Cleveland in the Final Four. They're going to face UConn. But it was just as recently as round two, probably, against West Virginia, where everybody was wondering if this team was maybe a little rusty. Did they really have it for this championship run? How were you able to see them get out of those first two rounds, probably not feeling so great about themselves, to the point where they survived the region of doom with UCLA and LSU?
I think that them getting out of Iowa City ended up probably taking a weight off the Hawkeyes' shoulders. They had so much pressure to win there. They obviously had the experience from 2 years ago of losing in the second round at home to Creighton and how that was such a huge, shocking upset. But we saw in that West Virginia game, it was really tight. And, you know, there was a moment there where we thought maybe it could happen again. But once they got past that and were able to get to Albany, they really started to gel, especially offensively. And I mean, if you really think about it, none of their games in the regional round were that tight. And then really, when we were talking about the region of doom and how difficult it was, there was always that thing that people said about Iowa, where we're like, you know, Iowa only has to face LSU or UCLA. They don't have to play both. And I felt like that's what really came into fruition this weekend.
Yeah. And so we've seen the Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese rematch. We all wanted to see it, but it's over now. And now we're going to get to see Caitlin Clark versus UConn's Paige Beckers. Man, how excited are you to see this? I know I am.
Oh, I'm so excited because I covered UConn with my old job. And so when Paige was a freshman, and it was this, you know, same time, obviously, that Clark was a freshman, they met in the Sweet 16. And that at the time was such a hyped matchup. And UConn ended up winning by 20. They've now both been, you know, Paige has been, this will be her third Final Four. This is Clark's second Final Four. And they've both been in the title game. They've both lost in the title game. They both want to get back there and ensure a different result. So I can't wait to be able to see these players finally meet again on the court with something huge on the line. And it's going to be a remarkable matchup, regardless of the result.
Yeah, one of the things about UConn that I know you've been discussing and I've noticed since the tournament started is, man, this lack of depth is going to be a problem to overcome. They basically play six players, mostly five players, most of the minutes, and they've got so many players out for the year with injury, most notably AZ Fudd. How were they able to pull this off and eventually beat USC and get to the Final Four?
They took a while to find their identity, and it took multiple conference losses to figure that out. It took some experimentation. What they ended up going with that's really worked well for them is essentially a forward guard lineup where, yes, Paige Beckers has to play the power forward position defensively most nights. And they start three point guards, though. They start Paige, Nika Mule, and KK Arnold. And it's really worked for them.
Beckers collects, spins baseline. Tough shot, gets it to go. She and Mule and Edwards have played every single second tonight.
They found a formula, and they kept believing. I remember Paige Becker saying, I haven't given up on this season. And this was maybe in February or January. And I think a lot of people maybe did probably give up on them. And I don't think UConn needs external motivation to get anywhere. I mean, this is a program that the internal standards are incredibly high and everyone knows them, whether or not they're spoken. I know Chino Auriemma, he's one that's maybe a little pessimistic by nature he says realistic, but he always seems to assume the worst. But he, after the game, after media, a small group of us were talking to him, and he said, honest to God, man, I can't believe this is actually happening. And I think he really, truly means that.
He seemed more emotional than we remember Gino Auriemma being in these moments, wasn't he?
I think he was. I've seen this team celebrate, or at least the seniors and Gino celebrate other Final Four berths in previous years. But this one, it felt different to them. You could tell the way that they were celebrating at center court, and like everyone was hugging each other. These embraces that were so kind of like tight and intentional, and it felt like they knew that they had worked harder than they'd ever had before.
Yeah, and this matchup is pretty fascinating. It's not just the Beckers versus Caitlin Clark situation. You've got a style matchup where Iowa's going to want to speed the game up, and UConn, obviously, with their limited depth, doesn't want to be able to play at that pace. But you've also got, if you go into the half court, really difficult matchup with the Paige and Aaliyah Edwards combination. So how do you see this matchup playing out? Which style will stand?
Well, it's funny because Gino Auriemma has talked about how UConn actually feels like it's better when it plays with pace, but that there's always just that element of like, do they get gas in the middle of the game, and does it then come back to backfire? So with me, when I think about this matchup, it's, you know, it is going to probably benefit Iowa still, though, if it is a track meet. I am also interested to see how, defensively UConn did, and we didn't talk a ton about USC yet, but they did a really good job of slowing down Juju Watkins and really USC as an entire unit. And Juju and Caitlin Clark have really different styles of play, but if they're able to harness that same defensive energy and come up with, you know, a specific game plan for Clark or for Iowa, then I'm really interested to see if that can kind of prevail, if they're able to come through with another really strong defensive performance. It's going to be a challenge to see how they unfold, and they have a little bit of history that they can draw from, but Clark's also way different and way better of a player than she was the last two times they played her.
Coming up, the other half of the bracket heads to Cleveland.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Okay, Alexa, let's head over to the other side of the bracket. First, we have the still undefeated University of South Carolina. What did we learn about the Gamecocks that we might see in Cleveland?
They definitely were battle-tested, I thought, in Albany. I mean, they gave up a big lead that they had over Indiana and really had to pull it out down the stretch there. And then Oregon State really hung with them for the majority of that game, even though Oregon State was dealing with some foul trouble. But it was kind of the tale as old as time as it's come to South Carolina this season, which is that they are just so deep.
And a steal from guess who? Watkins. Pow Pow eyes up, finds Fagan who lays it in.
They play nine players, and really any one of those nine can go off on any given night.
Watkins wanted Hall to shoot, I believe. Instead, she drives it here and banks it in. What a big take from Bree Hall.
And they still just keep finding ways to win, even if they give up a big lead or if they have a close game. Obviously, they have the memories from last year and how their season ended. So they have a chance to now get one step over that hump if they're able to take care of business against NC State. And, you know, the potential, we won't look too far ahead, but the potential of a South Carolina Iowa rematch in the national championship game would definitely be full of storylines. At least we could say it.
But let's go to the other team. And that's the more surprising team in the Final Four, the North Carolina State Wolfpack. Seems like everybody wanted to see Texas's freshman, Madison Booker, but NC State had other thoughts in mind. Besides sort of the asymmetrical court, what else did you see there in that matchup?
Isaiah James. Man, I mean, this is a player who was really a role player last year and the year before, when she's only one of two players that were part of NC State's run to the Elite Eight 2 years ago that are still on the roster. But she didn't even play in that Elite Eight game. This is nothing, obviously, against people who decide to go in the transfer portal, but it is, I think, still a cool story when someone kind of sticks it out and stays with that program and then ends up having, you know, putting in the work and being able to have things work out at their original school. And I feel like that's, this Isaiah James trajectory is really emblematic of that. So she made a career-high 7 3-pointers.
Allison Hayes all the way around, hitting Isaiah James. She relocates and hits a three again.
Between her and Saniya Rivers and Zoe Brooks, the guard play was just too much for Texas to really get a handle on.
Saniya Rivers is just dicing up the Texas defense.
Any NC State player goes to the rim, they go with the intention of getting a layup.
And that's such a good defensive team, but they look kind of like rocked back on their heels for, you know, really early on. And they made a run and they kind of got close, but they never really were able to overcome the early lead that NC State was able to get. What stuck out to me, though, I mean, again, this is a way different NC State team that lost in double overtime to UConn and Bridgeport. Obviously, the players were thrilled to get to the Final Four, and you know, they were picked to finish eighth in the ACC, so they were plenty glad to be able to prove those preseason doubters wrong, maybe even the doubters that still thought that as a three seed that they couldn't get past a team like Stanford that they beat in the Sweet 16 or a team like Texas that they beat in the Elite Eight. But I definitely think it meant something special for Wes Moore, who took over this program, and, you know, he's in the shadows of this legendary coach of Kay Yao, and he's able now to get back to the Final Four. It's, you know, only the second time they've been to that level in school history. And very, you know, in a cool way, they're able to also be there while the men have made their amazing run on the other side. And it definitely, you could tell how much it meant to him, too.
Well, everybody loves an underdog, but I don't know how much people love NC State, because as you mentioned, they want to see South Carolina versus Iowa, maybe even South Carolina versus UConn. What do you think we're going to see in Cleveland for this Final Four?
Anything I say right now, my picks have been really bad this tournament. So maybe you don't want me to pick your team. Even Monday, people were asking me about the games, and I was like, yeah, my gut tells me USC and LSU. So take this for what you will. Maybe you don't want me to pick your team. I feel like we're going to see, I don't think that it's impossible for South Carolina to lose. I do think there's a little bit of a blueprint that we saw in the regionals. Basically, NC State would have to make their threes. They should force South Carolina to take threes on the other end, but then they have to clean up on the glass and keep them from scoring second chance points. So that would be, I think, the roadmap for them to win. But I still think South Carolina gets it done. I think Iowa gets it done over UConn. I think I'm going to take South Carolina over Iowa in the national title game. But, oh, I mean, you have one team that wants to avenge a really tough loss over Iowa, you know, if this is the matchup we get, of course, from the Final Four. And then, you know, if Clark makes it to the national title game, she still wants that national championship that she wasn't able to get after losing to LSU. So they both have something to prove. It just makes me stress thinking about it, but I'm so excited. It's going to be remarkable regardless. Four really great teams, four teams playing their best basketball at the right time. So I don't know how it'll pan out, but I'm going to be freaking out on the sidelines throughout the whole tournament, probably.
Yeah, Alexa, and I hear the passion in your voice. And as I mentioned earlier, that Monday night felt like a Final Four night, and they had a record-shattering rating for LSU-Iowa, which proved that point. But I want to get your perspective as someone in the middle of all of this who's covered the sport for such a long time. Where are we now with women's basketball, and what does the future hold?
It was so cool to see everyone. It felt like either on my timeline or people that were texting me that I don't talk to on a regular basis, or don't talk to at least about women's basketball on a regular basis, that wanted to know my thoughts on the game, or that were texting me during the game and had, you know, things that they wanted to share or were enthralled by. And it really feels like, I mean, we've talked about how the women's game is even more popular than the men's game this year. And to be able to feel that, we all thought it was kind of building towards this throughout the season since the Final Four last year in Dallas and how that ended. It's delivering. The tournament, the players, the teams, the stars, everyone is delivering. It really just shows that women's basketball is this rocket ship, and you better get on board fast or else you're going to miss out.
Yeah, oddly enough, my favorite part was watching commercials with Caitlin Clark and Juju Watkins on them, and them being nationally recognizable beyond the basketball court. That, to me, was one of the ultimate signs of this rocket ship definitely taking off. Alexa, thanks so much for all your insight and passion there, and safe travels to Cleveland.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
The women's Final Four tips off Friday night on ESPN, with NC State facing South Carolina at 7 Eastern and UConn taking on Iowa at 9:30. I'm Israel Gutierrez. This has been ESPN Daily. We'll talk to you tomorrow.